Today's program is brought to you by Brooklyn Slate Company, a manufacturer of slate cheese boards, coasters, and other fine items. For more information, visit brooklynslate.com. You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, and welcome to the food scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell, here today with New York Times bestselling author Diane Mott Davidson. I have been kind of obsessed with the whole enchilada, her latest book. It dropped into my hands. I don't even know how it came to me, but now I can't live without it. And I've been backtracking to how many titles you have now? 16?
17. The whole enchilada is the 17th.
It's amazing. And just finding out about it now, I feel like I haven't lived my life yet. So I'm glad to finally be introduced to you as well as Goldie, the amazing, you know, caterer slash sleuth of your novels. But you are...
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. I mean, you are kind of... the Agatha Christie of the culinary world.
Oh my goodness.
I'm sure you've heard all those kind of accolades and comparisons, but really, it's kind of an amazing genre, a niche, and I wonder how it got started for you. I mean, where did you grow up? What was food in your life?
Actually, my father was in the Navy, and so we moved around quite a bit, and we're always having different kinds of food. And my mother was from Boston, actually born there and brought up there. And so we always had brown bread and baked beans, which were a real special dish for us.
Yeah.
And corned beef on St. Patrick's Day and, you know, so on and so forth. But when I was 12, I got a scholarship to an Episcopal school in Charlottesville, Virginia. It's still there. St. Anne's Belfield, it's called now. It used to be St. Anne's, all girls. Now it's co-ed. And my father at that point was at the Pentagon. And you could not imagine that 110 miles between Washington, D.C. and Charlottesville, Virginia would be so far, because I had never had Southern cooking before.
Yeah.
And it was just a different continent from Washington, D.C., truly.
Yeah.
And I loved that food, too. I thought it was fabulous with the sausage and grits and black-eyed peas and stewed tomatoes and so many dishes I had never heard of that were so important to Southern cuisine, and I just loved it.
You know, so, I think that starts to beg the question whether or not writing followed food or food followed writing. With this fascination already of cuisine, of these dishes, I mean, where did those paths cross? Where did you want to become a writer and food got folded in?
Well, I wanted to be, actually, it was my 10th grade teacher at St. Anne's who encouraged me to be a writer, and she's sadly dead now, Emil Jenkins. But she told me, look, you need to be a writer. That's what you need to do. But it took me a while to come around to what she saw when I was 14. And so, you know, I went to college, got married, went to graduate school, and, you know, eventually did volunteer work, and I tutored in a correctional facility, and I was a rape victim counselor, and in the course of all this, I thought, you know, I never did what my high school English teacher encouraged me to do. And, you know, maybe I need to do this. And so I started on it, took a class, and I loved it. And I took another class, and I loved it, but it took me a long time. I wrote short stories that I sent to the New Yorker and the Atlantic and so on. and finally thought, well, I want to write a novel. So I wrote one novel, and I wrote another novel, and I kept sending them out. And what happened was that one editor said, look, if you want to write a mystery, because both of those first two novels, now thankfully unpublished, had crimes in them, and this editor is now sadly dead also, but she said, look, go and outline some mysteries that you like. So this is where people who want to become writers can really use their academic skills. You know, outline what it is you like to write and what I like to read. And so that's what I did.
So what books did you go towards? I know you've referenced Robert Parker kind of being an influence.
That's right.
Yeah.
I loved reading Robert B. Parker because Spencer always cooks.
Yeah.
And I noticed that, that he would go out and be this sleuth and be looking at crime and be involved with the action and so on. But he would think about the crime while he was in the kitchen.
I know. I had seen the television show. What was it? Spencer for Hire.
Right.
And I don't think I realized until now how often he was in the kitchen.
Right. Well, in the books, it just seemed to me that he would go out and be an action hero and then come back and saute veal cutlets. And as he was sprinkling lime juice over them, he would think, oh, you know what? I need to look at this. And then I loved a book called, I love baseball anyway, so I love a mystery called Strike Three, You're Dead by Richard Rose.
Oh, yeah.
And fabulous book. And that was the one that I outlined. And it's 17 pages, single space. And also at that time, one of our children was in preschool, so I would take him to preschool, and I would only have 2 hours. So instead of going home and, you know, this is before answering machines, you know, listening to the phone ring and all that, I would go to this cafe that was sort of a bistro, but also a very upscale catering operation. And I saw these very wealthy people come in and, you know, order these elaborate meals. And I thought, that's interesting. So I put a caterer into the book I was writing at the time, which became Catering to Nobody. I made her a background character. And my critique group, which I also encourage people who want to become writers to join, said, look, this caterer is your main character. So I didn't know anything about catering. I knew I loved to cook, although it was a long, winding road for me to become a cook, because I couldn't cook at all when Jim and I got married. But anyway, I went to this caterer, and I said, okay, look, I will cook. I will work for you for free if you'll teach me about catering. And he said, come right into my kitchen. So that's how I got started. And I went out with the team on jobs, and it was so much more exhausting than I thought it would be, that I could not believe it.
Yeah, but I love how...
So I took notes, every time I was working on a book, I would go out and do a new event, like do a wedding reception or, you know, do a fundraising dinner, that kind of thing.
Yeah. It's just so great to hear, you know, that immersion, that, you know, you're in a sense staging at a catering company to learn more about writing about a caterer.
Yes.
And, you know, a fact that we haven't pointed out to, you had mentioned, you know, you had written a couple short stories, novels. You didn't get your first book picked up until after 40. Which, you know, and we hear about so many career changers in the culinary industry right now. People, you know, opening restaurants and people going to cooking school as a second, third, fourth career. But it's just so interesting to find that, you know, later in your life, this is where you kind of wove all those passions together.
That's exactly right. The thing is, I began writing shortly after turning 30. It just took me a long time to write a novel that was publishable. And that's also what I say to people who want to become writers, is think of writing as being like exercise. Maybe you don't really want to do it, or when you start out, you run out of breath pretty quickly, but it's still important to exercise every day, and it's important to write every day. And, you know, I don't know how much money there is in culinary careers right now, but I do believe that we can always improve the meals that we have at home. And, you know, not rely on, you know, the industrial food industry, but to say, okay, what kind of simple things can I prepare at home that will be delicious? And we have that for our whole lives.
Yeah. You know, and that's what I love about the book, too. It's not really an underlying theme. It's a pretty overt thing that, you know, the quality of food is important to you, too.
Oh, my gosh. Yes. Well, that was the first thing that I learned from John William Shank, who's the caterer whom I, you know, trailed around learning from. He said the caterers have access to ingredients that ordinary people don't have access to. But the thing that's what he said when I started out learning how to cater, which was like in the late 80s. But now, many more of those ingredients that only caterers and restaurants could get, those ingredients are available to the home cook, which is fabulous.
Yeah.
You know, really.
Do you remember the first dishes you helped prepare with John?
Well, you know, I do, because when you are a home cook, you plan meals and you do your grocery shopping and so on and so forth. And so you make, you know, manicotti or something like that with a salad and bread for, you know, your family's dinner. When I would arrive at John's kitchen, it was the very first day I arrived, I had to make green bean vinaigrette for 40 people. I just thought, okay, so what's fun about this?
Yeah.
No, it's and then you're moving on to the next thing, where you're doing a great deal of prep and, you know, making these. And, it's interesting, because when you make a family meal, you have the preparation, which I enjoy, the serving of it, which I enjoy, maybe the cleaning up I don't enjoy so much. But anyway, you have all those. But the main thing is that you complete the cycle, that people say, this is wonderful, this was so much fun, and you have so much social learning going on at the dinner table, and it's great. Catering and in writing, you do all this work during the day, but you don't complete the cycle. You know, in other words, the party isn't until the next night or the night after that, the day after that. With writing, you're working on a book for a year or a year and a half, and then it's published, and then you complete the cycle and people consume it, so to speak. So, it, you know, the catering and writing are much more similar than cooking and writing, in my opinion.
Well, we're going to take a quick break and then come back and talk about your illustrious caterer, Goldie Schultz, the woman behind the, you know, culinary murder mysteries. You've been listening to The Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network. We'll be right back.
Brooklyn Slate Company is a collaborative effort from Brooklyn graphic designer Sean Tice and Parsons graduate student Christy Hedeka. After visiting Christy's family slate quarry in upstate New York in the spring of 2009, the two grabbed a few pieces for use as all-purpose boards back home in Brooklyn. They found a number of purposes for the slate and began gifting pieces to friends. The response was so overwhelmingly positive that the two struck out to produce a line of slate products. They now make regular trips to the family quarry in upstate New York to hand-pick their favorite pieces of black and red slate. Some of the slate is sourced from the quarry graveyard, a collection of odd-shaped pieces that were ultimately destined to be ground for use as road cover or baseball diamonds. They then transport the pieces to their studio in Red Hook, Brooklyn, where they do additional cutting and clean the stone to be food slate. Every single piece of packaging that comes with their products, from the envelope to the burlap bag, can be repurposed for other uses. The end result is a product completely unique in cut, shape, color, and overall presentation. For more information and to order, visit brooklynslate.com.
Now through December, enjoy 10% off your purchase at brooklynslate.com with discount code HERITAGE.
Hey, and welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with Diane Mott Davidson, the woman behind 17 amazing culinary murder mystery books. You know, I want to talk about Goldie. It's amazing that she kind of was this subsidiary character in your first novel, Kittering to Nobody, and now, what, almost 23 years later, because that was published in 1990, 17 books later, Goldie is has a cult following, kind of like a lot of celebrity chefs. I mean, people are waiting for the next, you know, novel, next book to come out and see what Goldie's going to get into, you know, figure out, but also cook. Let's talk about Goldie for a second, because, you know, again, like Agatha Christie, she's kind of like the Hercule Poirot or Miss Marple.
Yeah.
You know, how did you develop that character? How did you create an arc?
Sure. Well, one thing, when I, you know, when we go to the refrigerator to take out ingredients to cook up a meal, what I say is that a writer goes to the emotional refrigerator to take out ingredients to cook up a book. And what I had noticed, Michael, in my volunteer work was that the women that I worked with, this was pre-OJ, mind you, we're talking middle-class women, and I kept running into this phenomenon of the battered wife. And this was like in my political party. This was in the church. This was in the League of Women Voters. And one of the women I worked with, who was my right-hand woman in my political party, said, I was the caucus chair, and she said, look at where my husband broke my thumb in three places with a hammer. And her husband was a social worker.
Yeah.
And a friend who was married to an engineer, and the engineer beat her up, and a relative married to a doctor, and the doctor beat her up, and this just went on and on and on. And so this was in my emotional refrigerator, that I wanted Goldie to be someone who had survived this and now was thriving. And so that's where Goldie came from, that she was going to be this strong character. And but also that cooking helped to heal her. The cooking for others helped to heal her. And she has, when the series begins, she has an 11-year-old son who, when the whole enchilada opens, is 17 years old.
Yeah.
And so, and their relationship has gone through all these ups and downs. And we have three sons, so I have plenty of material. So that's where Goldie came from. But I am happily married. And my poor husband, you know, we've been married since 1969. And he rarely comes to book events with me because inevitably someone comes up to him and says, are you the jerk? And he says, no. So, you know, he has suffered. But anyway, that's where Goldie came from.
You know, and in the whole enchilada, Goldie, her friend Marla, as well as Holly, three of the main characters, are in a group together of battered wives called Amour Anonymous. And, you know, with that, they find their strength. And, you know, in that companionship, they also share a lot of meals and, you know, a lot of, you know, riches through food. Now, you know, the murder mystery part of it all, It's fascinating because obviously as a food show, as a food person, I was drawn by that. But I'm even more smitten right now with how these stories evolve and how Goldie, you know, tries to figure out things, but intertwines that with, you know, trying to figure out recipes and trying to figure out people through their foods.
Sure. Yes. That's right. Well, actually, the idea for this book came from my doctor. And, you know, there was one time when I was talking to him about, you know, what would kill someone and how long it would take. And we were out in the hall of his, you know, physician's practice, and he was saying, well, you could use this. And I said, well, how long would that take, you know? And how long would this take? How long would that take? And then the lady who handles the insurance referrals came out into the hall and said, do I need to call the police? But anyway, see, it's a small town where Goldie is, Aston Meadow, Colorado, which is based on my own small town of Evergreen, Colorado. And so it's a certain kind of mystery. It's a traditional mystery where the town actually is almost a character in the book and in all the books. And we actually do have a lake there, which, you know, this summer we had the floods and so on, but the book was already out. But, you know, the weather in that part of the world plays a significant part in the books.
Yeah.
But anyway, so yes, they're all in the group together, but Goldie is not, you know, a criminologist or, you know, a private detective. She doesn't do DNA analysis. What she looks at is the relationships between people in her small town. And as a caterer, it's very interesting. It was very interesting for me going out on these catering jobs. The caterer was invisible. You know, it the same kind of invisible that a servant often is. And people would say things in my presence about other people at the party.
Mm-hmm.
But I simply, it was as if I was deaf.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is great. This is perfect. This is the perfect position for an amateur sleuth to be in.
Yeah. So. Amateur sleuth, but professional cook. And I want to get to, you know, some of the meat. I mean, from enchilada sweet sauce to not-so-skinny spinach dip, Julian's fudge with sun-dried cherries and toasted pecans. You know, your first dozen or so books had recipes within the story itself, and now it's kind of like a cookbook at the end of the book, you know, a collection of recipes. Now, again, enchiladas being such a main focus as well as the titular, you know, feature of this book.
Yes.
Did you think enchilada first and then evolve the cuisine within the book from that? Or did you write the story and then plug in food?
Well, I'm always sort of developing both at the same time, Michael, to be perfectly honest. And I was intrigued with the idea that, you know, actually the word enchilada comes, the chile, it was inside of the tortilla.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, why it's like chile within something.
Yeah.
But that's how it started. But then you had different kinds of fillings. And the Swiss enchiladas were popularized, you know, I learned from Rick Bayless, at the Sanborn coffee shops that were opened by and catered to the Swiss people living in Mexico or visiting Mexico.
Huh.
And so that's why it's dairy rich with cheese and crema you can make, which is crème fraîche, which you can make yourself, and I put the recipe in there. But a lot of people will just use commercial sour cream.
Yeah.
And our daughter-in-law is Mexican-American, so she gave me her grandmother's tortilla recipe. And so I made the tortillas and so on, and pretty soon it was becoming a very labor-intensive recipe, which people don't really like. And my taste testers actually preferred the store-bought corn tortillas to my corn tortillas. Like, thanks a lot.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's where the enchilada sweet sauce came from, is that I was just always testing this enchilada recipe that had a dairy-rich filling with chicken and then with a sauce that was the mild chilies that most Americans are used to, and tomatoes.
Now,
with
17 books and, you know, plenty of recipes per book, you must have a couple favorites.
Well, we do. We do. Actually, the family really... Well, first of all, my kids are the first testers. And what I learned, actually, from our priest in Evergreen was that... I know this would probably never be allowed now, but that for the kids who were going to be confirmed when they were 11, 12 years old, he would have them taste test different wines. I know this would never happen today. But what the kids preferred was Muscatel. And so that's what we always had in our parish, was Muscatel for the communion wine. But anyway, what he told me was that children have much more sensitive taste buds. And I think he was right. And so when our kids were growing up, I would make several different kinds of cookie several different kinds of cheesecake or whatever, and when the kids would have slumber parties or they would go to slumber parties, then they would vote on index cards for their favorite cookies and or cheesecake or whatever. And one year I was the soccer mom who brought the snacks after every soccer game, and then I would ask the kids, cheesecake A or cheesecake B? And so that's how we ended up with the cheesecake that's in the Last Supper.
Oh, I could just picture you being the favorite mom amongst all the school kids. We're gonna have dinner at Diane's house.
They always expected, you know, something, and I gave it to them.
Yeah.
But anyway, the point is that with those enchilada suizos, that's what the kids, our kids, our grown kids now, they're grown, asked for their birthdays.
Yeah.
You know. That they, what do you want for your birthday dinner? I said, oh, the enchilada suizas. And then another family favorite is the snowboarder's pork tenderloin, which is several books back. But it's easy, and you marinate the pork tenderloin overnight, but only over one night. And then they all love the stained glass sweetbread, I think I call it, which has, it's been so many books ago, it's hard for me to remember. People ask me, now, whatever happened to, I have no idea, you know, or what castle did you base the castle on? And oh, I'm like, oh my goodness, please don't. But I remember now, it was Bodiam Castle in England, where I actually had the floor plan and never visited for this particular book, which was Sticks and Scones. And Sticks and Scones is where the stained glass sweetbread is. So,
you know,
those are really the family favorites.
Yeah. And, you know, lastly, wordplay is just amazing. I mean, these are the titles of the books. Dying for Chocolate, The Cereal Murders, The Last Supper's Killer Pancake, Prime Cut, Tough Cookie, again, Sticks and Scones, Dark Tort. I mean, obviously they're a little tongue-in-cheek, but,
right,
you know, they are so emphatic about what kind of person you are, what kind of person Goldie is, and how fun these stories are to read.
Oh, Michael, you're so kind. Thank you. And I just remembered that the snowboarder's pork tenderloin is from Tough Cookie.
Excellent.
So thank you for bringing that up. And I couldn't believe that no one had used the title, The Cereal Murders.
Yeah.
So I thought, okay, I need to do this.
So, I mean, I'm sure you get asked all the time, and you've been producing for so many years. Is there another book coming out? Because I know a couple people were introduced.
Well, I'm working on a cookbook now.
Ooh,
and
excellent.
What I have found, because I have a contract for a cookbook, and it's interesting because what I have found is that writing a cookbook is very different from writing a novel.
Yeah.
And I find it actually very challenging. And so I promised the publisher, HarperCollins, that I would do a section on low-carb recipes. And I struggled and struggled and struggled with this. And finally I decided, because Marla, Goldie's best friend, and the other ex-wife of the jerk, has just lost 30 pounds on a low-carb diet, what made it much easier for me was to write the introduction to that chapter from Marla's voice. So that's what I'm working on now.
Oh, excellent.
And so that's why I thought, well, I'm going to write the cookbook, and then I'll see about the series.
Yeah.
And we'll see what's going on.
Well, excellent. I'll be looking for that book next. I mean, I have 16 other books after this one to read now. You got me hooked, I'm going to have to, you know, read all about Goldie's wonderful recipes. But, Diane, thank you so much for being on.
Thank you, Michael.
And
Thank you
so much for creating a character like Goldie.
Thank you.
It's so charming and delightful to have someone, you know, that has a common thread throughout a whole bunch of novels, a whole bunch of books, but that keeps on delivering such delicious things.
Well, thank you. That's so kind.
No
thank
problem.
You.
Excellent. Well, you've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.